makes me feel so doggone blue to listen to that old smokestack. Drivers are rolling on, leaving me here behind. Give me back them good old days and let me ramble down the line. That lonesome train, I love to hear the whistle blow. She's taking the sun and leaving the rain and making me want to go. I've got the blues, longing for her company. Many miles from where I am to the only one for me. It's so lonesome here, waiting for the manifest. I hope that engineer is kind enough to let me be his guest. Old pal to me, take me everywhere I want to go, get my transportation free.
Go ahead.
And Dave on the board. Let's see. This is the Prairie Monk Show for
the
15th of January 2017. And as always, this is our weekly look at things environmental and conservational and other things that Dave might be interested in talking about.
Say something about people who pass. I don't catch everyone, but I catch people whom I know and appreciate. Ned Caldwasser passed a while ago. It was just before Christmas. I had talked to him at memorial service to Shoemaker, and he was 97. He had was a physicist. He and his wife traveled a lot. He had been very solidly associated with the Batavia Accelerator. He was vice chancellor for academic affairs. And I chatted to him about University High School. He was an adamant educator, and he had done a lot to save the soul of University High School. And it touched the thread. He remembered it well, and he also remembered the school science curriculum project, which was a spin-off from his involvement with federal physics program. You know, the feds were getting together to give teachers a manual. It might have been chemistry. Loretta Jones was involved with that one here. There was biology and there was physics. And Ned had been involved with that. And as a spin-off, the school science curriculum project produced small elements of teaching, like a stream table or something like that, that would be infusible into an instructional program without sort of taking over from your school teacher who knows the children, and you want to give that teacher the capacity to fit into the overall program. An exciting life. And then just recently, Paul Hendren died. He was also quite a character. I talked to him in the street just a little while ago. And he was an attorney with Miller and Hendren, which is about a stone's throw away from Weft. And he was an attorney for villages, but the village of Savoy, I often was in the same room as Paul Hendren, and he was passing on legal documents and things like that. But very friendly soul with a background of interesting family history, as is most the case, or often the case with academic people. A quite different person was Matlock's family. And Betty Matlock passed, but Ray and Betty Matlock for years ran a laundromat, which was on campus where the current art museum, not the art museum, the current performing arts center is now, not quite on Goodman Avenue, but on Nevada, I think it was. But he was amazing because he remembered everybody's name, and Betty was there with him, and so that's just a local situation where he and his wife made a difference in the community. So now let's go on to soils. And I'm experimenting today. We've had printer problems with our printers, and so I can hardly read that. So I'm trying to use a laptop to get my thoughts across. Soils are tremendously important to agriculture. They're also important to housing and a whole bunch of other industrial things. If you go to engineering, you're going to get courses in soils related to the soil stability. If you're looking into agriculture, you're looking at people who will go out there and take a moist sample of the soil and mold it in their hand, sculpt it. And if it doesn't quite fall apart, you have a rough idea about the structure and texture of the soil and its fertility. If you're an old-style farmer, you can do that very well. It's a little bit like knowing that when the cloud comes up over the hill, that might bring water, it might bring floods. You can sort of have a sense. Well, there's something much more than that. The Russians were into it a lot. They started doing soil mapping and the like. And we had a fellow that is worldwide known. His name was Cyril Hopkins. And I grew up learning agriculture, and all the elements were spelt in his name. Cyril Hopkins Cafe Mighty Good. And so the Mighty Good was magnesium, you see. So each symbol had a reason for being there. May not have gotten all of them, but it gave you a rough idea of what was in the soil and what you were dealing with. Well, when I came to Illinois, there was Cyril Hopkins' lab. And Cyril Hopkins had been in Beltsville, Maryland, which is sort of the federal site for development of agricultural principles, and he had wanted to do mapping across the states. And it wasn't thought to be a good idea. So Cyril came to Illinois that thought it might be a good idea. And so Illinois was one of the first states to have soil mapping. And it's become important for lots of reasons, and I'll try and go through them. I mightn't get to all of them, this is not so academic as sort of just raising the importance of soils in agriculture and other things. Well, Cyril's lab was lined with lead so that you didn't damage the lab. It's been taken down now. It says, I think it's in anthropology or something like that, but it was in Davenport Hall. And so when that lab was taken out, there was a little bit of history that went. There's a lot of things to say about soils. First of all, soils are a function of a whole bunch of different things. Soils are a function of time. If you have glacial till, you may have gravel, but you may have very fine grained gravel and loose, windblown material that can fairly quickly convert into soil. So time, 10,000 years since the last glaciation, and if you've got a moraine like the Bloomington Moraine near to Rantoul, or the Yankee Ridge Moraine that comes through Urbana, or the Champlain Moraine that comes through and goes out towards Mahomet, or the Pisota Moraine, which goes south, parallel to 57 going south. These are all local moraines that feed into local headwaters. The Champlain Moraine falls into the Kaskaskia. On the north side of that same moraine, it falls into the Sangamon River. The Yankee Ridge Moraine falls into the Ombra, and it goes into the Wabash. The Pisotum, the backside of the Pisotum Moraine, also drains into that Ombra. And then east of that, we have the Salt Fork, which drains into the Vermilion River. And so you can map this sort of terrain, so time, terrain. So if you've got a soil in the wetland or an alluvium, you have an alluvial soil. If you have a salty area, we don't have a salty, we don't have an ocean, we don't have a dried up lake that's salty, but the classification of soils has changed a little bit. So now we tend to look at wetland soils or salty soils, or it's a slightly different classification. But you'll get the message, I think, from what we're talking about. So we go back to time and underground material. So if it's glaciation, it's glacial till. If it's on a sliding a glacier over limestone, it's limestone. If it's over vulcanated area, it's going to come over basalt or granite, and that's going to influence the nature of the soil. The soil is made, it's not just an amorphous mass. You may look at it that way, but it's composed of compounds of silica and aluminum and oxygen that create crystals. And some of those crystals have charges and some of them don't have as many charges. So if you're going to deal with an ocean bed that had been raised up and had a lot of leaching, then you may have a kaolinite crystal there that doesn't have a lot of charges and doesn't hold on to nutriments as well as a soil that had been worked on not only by time and temperature and organic matter. The organic matter would have a place to make a connection with a charge. If it hadn't been leached, it might be high in calcium. So what we look at is, first of all, the soil profile. So you get out there, and you can take a bore and bore down, but more likely, especially if you're teaching, you make a big pit, and you can see the nature of the cross-section. So something like aluminium would be deep and not very structured. Something like loess would be perhaps sometimes very deep, 4 feet or more, and you wouldn't be able to dig down below it, so it would be very uniform. If you were in a forest, especially if it was a pine forest, then you would have an acid sort of leaching, and you would create what is called podzolization. The chemicals would be leached out and down, and you would have a sort of sandy soil on top, not a lot of organic matter, but then you would have an accumulation of clay, and then you would have a ferric material underneath that. So you'd be looking at the soil type and trying to figure out whether it how deep was the loess that was on top of this soil. The loess was a wind-blown material, very fine material, blown across the state. And most of our soils in East Central Illinois are covered with loess. So you're looking at the amount of gravel in this soil. If you were on the Bloomington Moraine, where we have a prairie, the Pope Prairie, it was used for gravel. So you have gravelly nature. So then you're getting a feel. You can feel it with your shovel. You feel it with your hand. Soil like the Zinnia is very light and gravelly. That's a good soil for some people because it is a soil that is warms up earlier in the spring, and it drains well when in a county that wasn't very well drained. And so you have a sort of horse sense about this soil. But then you take it into the lab and you, first of all, have a set of sieves. And those sieves have different sizes in the, and you shake it and you get a rough percentage of how much gravel versus finer grained material. So that's a number one physical thing to do. You can also drop it into a chemical column and put materials through it to check its cation exchange capacity, the ability of this soil to accept nutriments. The soil chemistry is such that you have plates. And a kaolinate clay doesn't have as many plates and as many charges as, say, a vermilionite or other different soil chemicals. And if you were a sculptor, you probably would be looking for a soil that sculpts easily. So we're going to get a cation exchange capacity. We need to know its color. Is it organic matter? How much organic matter? So you burn the sample in a stove and figure out what is lost because the organic matter will burn. So you have an idea of the organic matter. And you can look at the calcium. If you are in the in East Central Illinois, there's where there's more rainfall, you're going to get calcium, which is one of the easier elements to leach. But if you go west, have a different amount of calcium. You're going to have perhaps less rainfall in some places, and so the calcium will be higher in the profile. So let me look at my notes here. We're trying to decide what the soil is about. I'm trying to see how to move this up and down.
Why don't I pop in really quickly here and mention to folks who might have just been tuning in that this is WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. We are one of the two community radio stations here in Champaign-Urbana. We've been joined in the last several years by WRFU over in Urbana, and we are all volunteers that you hear here on the radio. We have just a couple of paid staff, and they're behind the scenes. And this, again, is our weekly look at the environment, and Dave is giving us a lowdown on the chemistry of the stuff that we call dirt that we walk all over day in and day out around here.
Yes. So you're looking also for the chemicals that are in the soil, the nitrogen, the phosphorus, the potassium. So you get into a lab and you have tests for those elements. If you're in a salty area, you might be interested in the sodium content. So we have a fairly flat county and fairly waterlogged county. But you have, even so, a gentle rise to moraines, and you have what is called a catena, a set of soils that might be in a very low position would be a drummer. You get a little higher, you get Flanagan, and then you get higher yet, and you might get a zinnia. And that is called a catena. It's a sort of cross-section of an environment. But you have to know that that's not enough. You need to have a soil diagram so that you will have alluvium where the riverbed is, because there will be leaching from the upper lands onto the alluvium, and that would be more nondescript, not with a soil profile. But then on the ridges, you would have a range of different associations. So if you were near Paxton, you might have an Elliott association. Often the names given were the names of people or places. And so it depends on the soil definition, and so there might be one soil type bridging into another. So if you want to do that, you go to a soil survey. So I have with me a soil survey book. It's about an inch thick, and it has lots of maps of the soil, so you can go find your particular soil. And These days, you can computerize that, and you can get your computer in your tractor to have an idea of the soil type so that you will plant fertilizer and herbicide according to the capacity of that soil to accept it. We don't want to have that chemical rolling off into the water and down to the Mississippi and creating a hypoxia or a dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. So the more sophisticated farmer these days is planting his fertilizer or her fertilizer according to the soil type. And I'm doing this in winter time because sometimes, especially in the spring and also in the fall, but the fall covers it with the plant material that's left from the last crop. So in spring, you can often see the soil types. You go along in a car on a country road, you can see what is a forest soil, what is a prairie soil, and then in the prairie soils, you can get an idea of what is more clay and what is more deep. And you can watch these catenas so that you see the deep drummer soil nearer to the wetlands, and it's easy to see it also from aerial photographs. So most of the maps that we have in these books are aerial photographs, and they're done periodically. So right here I have two different soil surveys. One is a little older, and you can tell because it's all done with a typewriter, and then we get a more computer-era soil survey. So each of the counties have that sort of base. And believe it or not, this soil type gives you the tax base because this soil drummer may produce more product, commodity, corn, soybeans, wheat, oats, barley, whatever, you're going to have an advantage if you have a better soil. So your tax is based on the soil type. So it's important to farmers to know what their soils are. Western Europeans came and drained the soils like Flatville, and that liberated some of the deeper soils, and then some of the more richer soils in the world. You have to also know that soils have bacteria and microorganisms, and one spoonful of soil will contain millions and millions of microorganisms that we need to be there in the future. This is our genetic gene pool. So it's not only plants and animals, the flora and fauna, it's the microorganisms that make this soil work. And they're dynamic. So if you go in there and check out a soil for this particular climate, this particular temperature, this particular rainfall, at this particular time, it may be different in 6 months' time when you check it in the climate and the various factors have changed. To be helpful in this area is to have soil diagrams so that you see the Bloomington Moraine, you see the outwash plain, you get an idea of what is you're looking at then in a map. And a map is sort of looking down on the scene, and you can tell there's a moraine in this location because the outwash plain soils are in a slightly different location. The backside of the moraine is not, in its day, was glaciated, and it wasn't leaking as much water as if you were on the front side of the moraine where it was falling out. So you have palmate creeks and rivers that go into swampland, and so our early agriculturalists had to drain that. And the people who had been draining soils in Europe knew about that, and they came to places like Flatfield and drained. The early draining had to be interesting. How do you create a river out of a swamp? Well, you create a dam and you put in a pontoon with a crane on it, and you have a drag line and or grab, sometimes usually a set of tongs coming together. As soon as you lift the drag line, it pulls up a bunch of muck, and then you put that in a levee. And so as you go down the river that you're creating, your pontoon is supported by the water that's dammed up behind the river that you haven't made yet, and then you make a levee, and that levee also prevents flooding in the future. Sometimes you had a big plow, and you had a team of oxen that would plow a ditch. Sometimes you would have a steam tractor that would do the job. But basically, people were getting water off the swampland, and if there was a semblance of a river, rivers tend to meander, so you would have a big gooseneck meander as the water fell slowly, and you would cut across that and create a what is called a channelized environment, so that the river ran quickly to the sea. That's not always ideal, because if you do that, you carry a lot of soil with the water, and that's what creates that hypoxia zone in the Mississippi and the Gulf. It's not only that, we also have a lot of runoff. If you don't do that planned fertilization, planned herbiciding, you have the chance for excess chemicals going into that water and creating a problem too. To try and counter this, there's people who want the water off quickly, and Champaign County would not have been Champaign County if it didn't get rid of its water. But then you have to feed aquifers. We are lucky to have one of the best aquifers in the world, and it hasn't been challenged by the input of plastics and chemicals. And we've had lots of battles about that because we have a landfill on top of a aquifer locally at Clinton. We want to have runoff, but not too much runoff. We also need to be able to have water moving through the soil into the aquifer. It might take, if you're in the east end of the aquifer, you might be take 1,000 years for that water to filter into the. If you're on the west, where the aquifer has been exposed, like at Beardstown, the aquifer is almost to the surface, so rainfall that falls onto that particular aquifer and onto the sand dunes created by the loess is going to get into the aquifer fairly quickly. So we're jealous of the water running off too fast. So there is a battle between people who want to get rid of the willows and the people who want to have the willows remain some so that the roots will encourage infiltration. And the big problem is this, is that if those willows get too strong, then you're going to have flooding and you ruin your crop. So there's a balance here between those that want runoff and those who want to have absorption. Some of the rivers that were created are big enough that you can actually navigate them with a canoe, or in flood time you can come up with sometimes a paddle wheeler to some of the upper reaches of the rivers. I can remember going to Ricker Library to and found a series of pictures of the upper reaches of the Mississippi, and there was a paddle wheeler sitting in the soil, and what had happened was that the captain of the paddle wheeler had gone up the river when it was in flood time, and he had gotten drunk and he'd gotten into jail, and he couldn't remove his paddle wheeler soon enough that it the river went down, and there he was sitting in the middle of nowhere. That happens. So we've dealt with profiles, we've dealt with catenas, and we've dealt with soil association. So if you go to Paxton, you will be near Elliott, and there's an Elliott association. So you may have a catena with a Drummer Flanagan in it, but you would have an Elliott. And if you're a farmer, you can get to know how that these things sort themselves out. Now you have engineers. So I have here a very nice article by Susan Mittenthal, who's a local person who's gone to Indiana, and she does things with trails. So if you're a trail person, you are dependent on the trail being relatively stable. If you put a trail into soft soil, then you're going to have it erode. And some trails have been designed in a way that is not cautious of the erosion. And we have a Kickapoo trail, which is very, very wide, but it is on a railroad bed, and it is stable, and it won't be open until the summer, but it will be a stable soil underneath there, mainly because it's been constructed as a stable soil. You still have to watch, because that may sink in some cases if you have a creek or a river running under the railroad bed. Then there's a chance that you will have sinking and cracking, and that will happen to bridges too. So one of the things you want about a trail is that you want people to experience what's on the edge. So if you have engineers who construct a trail by sculpting the soil on either side, you destroy the native vegetation, which is often the only vegetation on either side of the trail. So we've been a little sad to lose a lot of our original prairie in the vicinity of Mayview, with the first phase of the Kickapoo Trail, which is 7 miles long, and it's not 7 miles wide, but it sinks. You think it is sometimes. It is hugely wide, and it takes people away from the elements. So if you allow horses to come onto this trail. Horses have hooves, and if you're in the back country and you're working with cattle or sheep and you have a pony, it doesn't matter if you take a divot of soil each time you start off and the horse is moving rapidly. It's even as helping to create the soil by it's a little bit like you're taking a shovel and turning it over. But horses on trails are sometimes very destructive. There's a Jubilee State Park west of Peoria, and so help me, the trail has gotten deeper and deeper, and the mullock from the horses has made a levee on either side, which is okay if you want a river, but if you want a horse track or you want hikers to experience it, then you have to say no to horses. Horses need a firm base. Builders need a firm base. In Lake Park, we have cornfield converted to development. And the Lake Park has a berm because builders don't like to build on soft soil. So they remove the soil, and that means that Lake Park has bought that soil or acquired that soil, and it's a berm that's about 20 feet high and about 50 feet wide. It allows you to see down over the prairie. It's a prairie itself, but it is one of the richest topsoil prairies in the world. It's a reconstruction prairie, but it indicates that builders aren't really going to build on topsoil. Now, there's a controversy there because sometimes when you take over your house, you're given about 3 inches of topsoil, and the water can come down off of the house and run under the on top of the clay base and erode that 3 inches. So if you're going to build a garden around a house, you need to bring in enough topsoil to make it work. And you need to make sure that it is not easily eroded by water that takes the topsoil away. Sometimes drains are created that are on roadsides where there's very little organic matter left. And then we have a problem because roadsides like to get to create a green image very quickly, and they have traditional roadside plants, ryegrass and brome, and they mix in sometimes some legumes like sweet clover. We don't really enjoy that, but it's difficult to get the traditional plants to grow on the roadside. So prairie with its deep roots and sometimes deep tap roots like a coneflower, or fibrous roots like a little blue stem or big blue stem or Indian grass, they will help to stabilize the soil. You have again the problem of having organic matter that erodes quickly. So do you, going back to the trail situation, do you allow four-wheelers? Do you allow fast bicycling? Some of the nature trails are not regulation 10 feet or 12 feet wide. They're 2 feet wide, and they're one-way trails so that you don't have to have a wide place to pass someone on a bicycle, and it's created more for hiking rather than for biking or for four-wheelers or for horses. different trails for different groups. If you're in the rough terrain of Vermilion County, where there was mining and the soils have been disturbed anyway, you can sometimes allow bicycle trails and off-road vehicle trails, but you be careful to allow a certain sort of drainage. So instead of letting the water run down the trail and across it to make a sort of little rivulet, then you put in a box culvert and allow the water to run under the trail. So there's certain precautions that you can take to make it accessible for people and for reuse. There's sometimes a tendency to let the trail erode and then move it to a new place and leave the old trail to reconstitute itself. That's a little cruel. So you need to think about how you design trails and how they will be used. You may even have to charge people differently if they want to use it in a different manner. If the horses want to use a trail and you can consider that possible, then they need to pay more for the maintenance that is necessary to go with the trail. I'm just looking at Susan's notes here. You want to think whether you want a park or you want a trail or you want a natural area, and they're not always compatible. So people who are in the recreational business are often in the park business, and they want open space and toilet facilities and a lot of amenities that don't come with the people who hike. So people who hike can also handle a staircase that's made up of logs put across the rise, so that you have a way of getting up on a staircase without slip sliding and creating an erosion situation. All this relates to engineering and soil science, and we really want to encourage the moves in soil science to know how the elements come together, to know the bacteria, the fungi, the paramecians, the creatures that are in there, how they meld together and help to create organic matter. Often we have used all the organic matter that we have on the top soil created with the aid of prairies. So we have people who are farmers who are considering contour planning, plowing, rather than just running corn rows up and down a slope. They put them around the slope. It's not helped by the fact that we have a very square plat. It's north, south, east, west. It's called a Jeffersonian plat. And if your property is Jeffersonian plat and somebody else's property is on the contours logically should go through both farms in a contour manner. And so that is sometimes possible if you have large farms rather than family farms. So there's some debate about the efficiency of farming land that is a huge acreage where you can do contour plowing, you can do strips of vegetation. We have farmers that are putting in prairie. You also have to realize that you have huge equipment and it has to sometimes move up and onto the berm that is creating your contour so that water can move off in a sensible manner or be absorbed. And So you have to know that sometimes prairie is 8 and 10 feet tall, and you can't see your way through it. So not all farming likes to have a filter strip of prairie. On the other hand, if you're growing vegetables and you want pollinators, you had better have a multi-purpose prairie that will grow on a contour and create a friendly atmosphere for not only Italian bees, which give us our honey, but for a multitude of bumblebees that are very rare. And they're losing out, basically, because they have no habitat. So a lot of these creatures, including bees, are in town now because the town has gardens and are caring for butterflies and birds and bees. And so we do have hawks and owls and goldfinches and wrens right in town. And so we hear about it on the radio. But in a way, our landscape that a group called Graeber and Graeber followed a bird survey from north to south in Illinois. They followed about a 1900 transect and did about the same thing. And virtually the only real population of birds are aluminum planes that are in the sky. It's a lot of the bird diversity has gone. We've lost passenger pigeons. We've lost, and we're losing biodiversity at a tremendously rapid rate. So we have to be cautious about how we use our land. There are other people at the county board level that are adamant that we should not be extending our cities in a manner that takes over our world-renowned soils. We need in-building. So do we take our school outside of town? Do we take our libraries outside of town? Do we take our post offices outside of town? Or do we keep them inside town where people can use bicycles and Shanks's pony, which is a reference to your legs. You can walk, so when you look at that dirt, think about it, and think about how valuable it is. And sometimes you want to get your child out into that dirt so that they actually enjoy it. So I can remember field trips with people who helped us to put in a prairie at Lake Park, and they enjoyed just working with this soil and feeling it. And we need people to know that, because you need to know where your apples come from, where your onions grow. And it's kind to have an organization like the co-op in a banner that helps farmers to do work with organic farms. We have not only animals but plants that have taken tremendous advantage of the way we work with soils. It used to be that we had a moldboard plow. John Deere invented a moldboard plow. It would go down 10 inches. It had a shear on the front, and then it had a moldboard that turned the soil over and got rid of the prairie. But more recently, that's been regarded as kind of heavy erosion territory. So you have no-till, so that you have an S-shaped tine, and as it goes through the soil, it sort of shuffles, and you leave your organic matter on top. and that reduces the erosion. Then we have a problem with people who feel that material has organisms in it that are going to make it more difficult to herbicide the territory. So they put a higher rate of herbicide on. So we haven't exactly solved the problem of no-till, but it certainly has reduced the amount of erosion going down the Mississippi. In some places where you take water out of the aquifer and put it into a river, and then later, like Decatur takes a lot of its water out from behind Allerton Park at Monticello and puts it into the river so that it then can take up the nitrates and the phosphates and that run into the river, and then they have to try and eliminate those elements by treatment and filtration at a water purification plant. That sometimes doesn't read sense to me. I would prefer to see that sort of water pumped to Decatur so that it would not have to be purified in the same way. But we have to think about these things, and we have to ask you to think about it so that you can get onto the city council or the soil and water board, or so that you can plant a prairie on your little plot of land. It can be 10 feet by 10 feet, and you can still have a prairie. You have to have lots of light, but then it might be that you have an area of prairie. The Barnhart family has put in, they were at one stage thinking about 400 acres of prairie on Yankee Ridge, and the soil and water people and the university that's now assumed that farm have done work to preserve the dignity of the prairie. It's a planted prairie, but it gives people an idea of what a prairie looks like. You can go there for perhaps a wedding or an event. You look over the Ombra, and you look across to the Pisota Moraine to Savoy, and in the moonlight, that can be a thrilling place to be. People think that we have a very flat land, but if you look at the micro details, it's quite diverse, and you can get your jollies out of a fairly small amount of 4-inch rise, whereas if you come from mountainous areas, you might be looking at the 2,000 feet rise, and it's a different sort of excitement. So people who leave the flatland for some time often almost cry when they come back, because here are the elevators, here is the flatland, and they start to realize that it has a certain quality. There's an ethnicity to this. Sometimes you will have farmers who are different in style. So the Deutschlander and the Frieslander in Flatville is different from the Irish person that was on the hill who wanted to have the Flatlanders and the Frieslanders wanted to drain, and then they knew about soft areas. The Irish on the hill were more used to rolling acres and a different lifestyle. So if you go to Paxton, you have a Scandinavian group, and how do they work with the land? We have only 1 minute left. Well, I encourage you to think about your soils and think about the people who are in it and the people who settled it. And I was going to say something about books that do some of that sort of thing, but we'll have more to come. And this is Dave Monk, your Prairie Monk, WEFT Champaign 90.1 on your FM dial.
And Dave on the board. As always, the views and opinions expressed are solely those of the speakers and nobody else. You can catch up on these episodes if you've ever missed one and you wondered what Dave was talking about. If you go to YouTube and type in The Prairie Monk, you will probably find his channel, which has 150 hours of Dave's conversation, enhanced because Dave and I go through his photo collection and we create maps that show the things he's been describing, and we add them to the video so you can see those in addition to hear what Dave has been talking about in the episode. Again, that's if you go to youtube.com online and type in their search engine, The Prairie Monk.